Welcome to Sword and Laser, episode number 23. I'm Veronica Belmont.
And I'm Tom Merritt.
And we are doing a special live show here at Dragon Con.
Look, there's people. Wow.
Phenomenal. Full house. I'm pretending it's Dignation here.
People
today.
Showed up. Veronica has a beer.
I figure I'm on quasi-vacation, so it's okay. I'm not on the clock, technically. But we have a great show today. We have author Timothy Zahn here to talk about his work. But first, we'll get to our quick burns for the evening.
Yeah, we'll recap the Forever War in the next episode, if you're waiting for that. And we will have an episode by the end of September, right?
Yes.
We won't make you wait another month.
I stayed up till 2 o'clock a.m. last night finishing the book, because Tom and I have this little competitive thing going where we have to be at roughly the same point in each book, or else the other one like freaks out and has to catch up. And as you know, did anyone follow along with the last book when we read George R. R. Martin? Anyone?
No. I know one guy admitted it earlier.
You guys? Anyway, we got totally hooked on the Song of Fire and Ice series, and so we continued reading the books. And I finished book three just recently, and then I was like, all right, I'm going to take a little break and start reading The Forever War. And what happened was I got sucked in, couldn't get into The Forever War, and then Tom suddenly leaped ahead by reading it in like an hour or something.
It was a weekend.
Yeah.
It's a quick read.
It was like an hour. And then started reading A Feast for Crows, which is the book four of the George R. R. Martin series. And so then I was like, crap, I gotta catch up. And so I read it last night. So
faster
take that, Merritt.
She read it in a half hour. All right, quick burns, unrelated news of the month. A new Hitchhiker's Guide book will be out October 12th. And if you're wondering how could that happen, Owen Colfer is actually picking up the sequel based on some notes. And it unfortunately is not getting terribly great reviews on the blogs.
Do we have fans of Douglas Adams in the house?
Do we have fans of Owen Colfer in the house?
Yes.
Oh, look at
yes.
that. Very good.
An Artemis Fowl fan. Excellent. Well done.
So he seems up to the test, but I guess the question is, should one carry on a series when the author passes away? And obviously there are times when it is important, like say in Robert Jordan's case,
yes.
right? Where you really want it to be finished.
Did I say that really convincingly? It's like, yes.
And then there are other times where it's sort of like I think in the case of Frank Herbert with Dune, where it wasn't necessary, but it was kind of cool that they, you know, expanded
yeah,
the universe.
Yeah, you seem to like them, especially.
Yeah, I do. I do like them.
Am I so drunk that I don't realize everything I say is hilarious right now? One beer.
And so I think it's a big task to pick up for Douglas Adams. And I think a lot of people are going to come into it not wanting to like it.
Well, yeah, because people get really attached to their authors and people get really attached to the series that surround these authors. And when someone kind of picks up the mantle and starts continuing that saga, you get kind of like weird about it. You get kind of possessive about it. And I think that's what's happening right now. People respect him definitely as an author, Colfer. And I think they're a little bit worried that it's going to be too different. But people who are very close to him as an author are saying, no, you just have to get used to his humor. He has a very specific kind of humor that we think will mesh well with Douglas Adams and that whole universe. But, you know, it's going to be hard to say. People are giving it a chance, but at the same time, they're like, this isn't the same kind of funny that we're used to.
According to KeepingTheDoor.com, it seems like people who are familiar with Colfer's previous work tend to like this because they're like, oh, yeah, I liked him. I like Douglas Adams. It all works for me. But people who are unfamiliar are being a little harsh and saying, why do we need Slaughterhouse-6, Lord of the Rings 2, George Orwell's 1985.
Lord of the Rings 2, Pippin Longstocking. I didn't come up with that. Cory Doctorow did, but it's still funny. Or actually, one of the forum posters.
Yeah,
did.
One of the forum.
Hey, oh, that's the next story.
The internet can be harsh.
Yeah.
Yeah, the next story, Ariel.
Well, I actually wanted to ask, what do you guys think about another author picking up the mantle of a series?
It's interesting that Tom mentioned Robert Jordan in particular, since a lot of his earlier works were Conan the Barbarian books. So it's sort of expected that someone will continue his work, since he was working on Howard's works for all those years.
Yeah, the other thing with Robert Jordan, though, is I think he left copious notes for how he wanted the series to end. And it's a little bit different when you actually have a very direct, you know, sequence that you're supposed to follow, a clear vision of what's supposed to happen to finish off the series. And when you're just kind of writing out of the blue, maybe there's a little more, you know, grasping at straws and trying to complete something that doesn't necessarily, you know, have a direction yet.
I thought the Spider Robinson did an excellent job of Heinlein's Variable Star.
Okay, good. Then that's one success story in your mind. That's good. That is a negative comment. I've learned recently that when I'm not being sarcastic, I sound sarcastic, and when I am being sarcastic, no one knows.
In your mind.
Kind of like.
Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say that in this particular case, Douglas Adams had a very unique sense of humor, and just like Monty Python, I don't think anyone else can pull it off.
Writing styles are very different from writer to writer, and someone as unique as him, yeah, you're right.
They're like fingerprints.
It's a tough job.
Well, I think it depends on if the authors knew each other. Now, I don't know if Ian Colfer knew Douglas Adams. If they were drinking buddies and he confided how he wanted everything to go, then that's great. Mm-hmm. But from what I've read of Artemis Fowl, I love the books, but they're very different than Hitchhiker's Guide. So if he's going to put his own brand on it and take it to a totally different place, it might be worrisome.
Yeah,
I think a lot of the conventional wisdom is that there wasn't a need to go on with the series.
It ended
was
on
fine.
A good note. There wasn't. Yeah.
Yeah,
there
wasn't
if you
this,
call the movie a
oh no,
good
we've
note.
Left it unresolved or anything. Yeah.
I mean, especially with like Frank Herbert and Robert Jordan, they had the books, the series are being continued by people who were close to them or at least knew them pretty well, like Brian Herbert, for example, being his son. So I think that is more into that kind of situation where they were very close to them and knew possibly how they wanted things to continue.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so how does this conversation differ from, say, a movie adaptation?
I don't think it really does too much, because I think a lot of adaptations, well, I mean, we can look at George R. R. Martin, for example. It's not a movie adaptation, but it is the HBO series that he's working on, which we're going to talk about more later. But he has a very close hand in a lot of the stuff that's going on, especially with the writing of the screenplay, I guess, for the TV show. Is it a screenplay when it's a TV show?
Or is it's
a
script.
It's a script? Okay.
Yeah.
So I think it is very important for the creators of that next adaptation to have close ties with the original creator, because then it can kind of lose the focus. Although I guess there's been situations where things have gone okay.
And it is a little different because you're retelling the same story in a different medium versus carrying on a story. So there's some
liberties.
Things, you know, you're still working within the same form. Whereas when you go from a book to a movie, there's just things you can't do without being annoying anyway, like constant voiceovers telling you the thoughts going through people's heads and things like that.
So. Yeah, the other thing that's interesting about the new Hitchhiker's book is that it's a standalone book. You don't necessarily have had to have read the, you know, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy to understand what's going on in this next version, which I thought was really interesting. They do a little bit of a explaining in the beginning, like in the prologue, but it can stand alone. So that makes me wonder, you know, why not just write a different book, I guess? You know, like, why bother making it a Hitchhiker's book? But anyway, all right, should we continue?
Yeah, if you're looking for something to fill some time in between Sword and Laser books, or you're just a voracious reader, Ariel by Stephen R. Boyette has been re-released in an expanded version. Cory Doctorow was going off about it on Boing Boing. It first came out in the early 80s. The premise is, one day at 4:30 p.m., the world changes, complex technology, anything beyond a simple machine stops working, magic starts working, planes fall out of the sky, dragons take wing, chaos racks the world, riots, starvation, murder.
It sounds really awesome, but it totally reminds me of the Tad Williams book, War of the Flowers. Has anyone read that one? Any Tad Williams fans?
You can clap for yourself.
He's one of my favorite authors, and it's kind of a similar idea about how a, if I recall correctly, it's been a long time since I read it, but there is kind of a tear in reality where suddenly a fairy world and our world are interconnected, and you can kind of go back and forth between the two, and it's really interesting. This doesn't really seem like there's two different worlds. It seems like suddenly just magic
exists within our world.
Everything
just changes.
It's kind of elf punkish too, in a way.
It seems a bit, yeah. Dragon punkish.
Real genre.
Yeah.
Real genre.
We've chosen an elf punk book before on Sword and Laser Book Club.
So. Unshapely Things was an excellent book.
Check it out.
If you're intrigued by that genre, that's a good one to start with.
All right, let's. We were talking about screenplays and TV adaptations, and we briefly mentioned Game of Thrones. They have announced casting for the Game of Thrones miniseries that will be on HBO, right?
Yes.
Yes, HBO Game of Thrones, set for sometime in 2010.
And some of the casting is just really incredible. They just announced Cersei Lannister as being Lena Headey from Sarah Connor Chronicles. They're going to make her blonde, obviously, because Lannisters are blonde.
That was my first question, but she's brunette.
Yeah, I said the same thing, and they're like, well, hair dye exists, Veronica. I was like, oh, yeah. Peter Dinklage is going to be Tyrion Lannister, which I think is excellent because he rocks. Yeah, he's a phenomenal actor. And Sean Bean is going to be playing Eddard Stark, who, of course, we all know as Boromir. So, yeah.
Yeah, I got some Sean Bean fans out there.
Yeah, and I just love how really excited George R. R. Martin is about all of this process. He keeps a live journal blog, which I think is really cute.
Yeah, but you know that opens him up to all the fans criticizing him, like, why didn't you come out with book five instead of live journaling?
Yeah, and exactly. Oh, man.
I didn't say I had that.
He's not our bitch, Tom.
No, we have learned that from Neil Gaiman. And I agree.
Neil Gaiman, quite succinctly put, he is not our bitch. Am I allowed to swear on Dragon Con?
You okay, just did. Thank you.
More swearing.
They're going to start bringing you up more Stella.
Yeah. Bring up the whiskey and I'm good to go.
No, but I think Sean Bean is a fantastic pick. I mean, I could see Boromir as sort of an alternate Eddard Stark, a mm-hmm. little less moral, but the same sort of like, you know, mythic character, same sort of gravitas.
The guy that got to play Jon Snow, though, is a little too much of a pretty boy for
Kit
my taste.
Kit Harington?
Kit Harington. He's a good-looking lad, but he is just a little bit too pretty.
He's comely?
He's a comely lad. We're speaking old-timey over here.
Do you mislike that word, sir?
Mayhap I choose a different one. No, but yeah, they've got a lot of really great actors. They've got some first-time actors, too, to play Arya and Sansa Stark, which is really cool. Arya looks exactly like I pictured her in my mind, so I'm really excited about that. And the Sansa actress has never actually done anything professional before. She's done, like, some high school plays and community stuff, but has never done any TV or film. So it'll be interesting to see how they adapt to this new world.
I actually think Jennifer, how do you say her name, last name? E-H-L-E, Eel? Ale?
Ailey?
Jennifer Ale as Caitlin Stark. I think she looks the part.
Yeah.
It's kind of the way I imagined her. So.
But of course, you know, with makeup and with hair and with costume, anyone can really almost start looking like anyone.
Peter Dinklage could be Caitlin Stark.
That's a stretch.
You need a really good makeup department.
Oh, and the girl who's playing Dany Daenerys is also...
Tamsin Merchant?
Yeah, she is in
I sound really smart because I'm reading it off
IMDb. Show? It's at the... what's the show with the hot guy on show 9? The Tudors. The Tudors?
Oh, the Tudors.
Yeah,
right.
She's on... You know, that one. So yeah, I'm really excited about it. Are you guys going to watch it when it comes out on HBO?
Game of Thrones? Show of hands. How many people... I'm going to watch Game of Thrones, HBO.
Excellent.
Show of hands. I'm not going to waste my money.
I don't care. Oh, okay.
Oh.
I don't have HBO, but I'm actually considering like getting it for
show
this.
Show hands, BitTorrent.
Oh.
Uh-huh. You people are the problem.
You're the problem. They haven't
right
found me yet.
The law. All right.
I mean, I shouldn't say that in a public forum.
Time to bare your sword. We got some feedback from the audience on previous episodes and previous topics. Why don't you go ahead and kick us off with Alden's
Alden wrote, a phenomena occurs occasionally where I'll be reading a book concurrently with playing through a video game, and my reading of the novel is affected. This time around, it's Warcraft 3 and the Forever War. Reading through a description about a certain base under construction, all I could envision was little soldiers with low polygon counts and blocky gray buildings rising whole from the surface. I don't believe that was the author's intention. Of course, it occurs with movies. Reading through The Lord of the Rings will never be the same for any of us, for example, but video games present a more stylized version, which really F's my S up. Wait.
That's the way he wrote it.
I can't do it. I can't do it. I'm too, like, conditioned to not swear, for lack of a better phrase. It really points to how subjective an experience reading a novel is. Does this happen to anyone else? Milder forms include casting actors or friends in roles, or envisioning natural sex... or envisioning natural settings... as, it was... The mic went bad.
Hey, give it here, Merritt.
I made it through three paragraphs not slurring or doing anything wrong, Tom. That's why descriptions of nature scenes have always been difficult for me. I live in a bubble.
So, yeah, I've definitely had this sort of thing happen, although never the video game affecting the book like that, although I can totally see the Warcraft 3 Forever War connection. Yeah. Anybody else out there had this sort of, like, cognitive dissonance where you get so sucked into a book or maybe even a movie that you just start to see it everywhere? Everybody's like, yep, but I'm not sharing.
I'm watching.
Too embarrassing.
Sometimes I have to cast things in my head. I have to pick actors or whatever that are playing them.
Casting your actors for stuff, totally. Or imagining what they look like, you just pick like a form that you're familiar with, definitely.
Yeah. Pac-Man.
Pac-Man's an interesting choice.
Do tell.
I like Robin Williams for Tom Bombadil.
Oh.
That's smart, actually. They should not have cut Tom Bombadil.
Do we have another one?
I have it happen to me where I'll be reading a long series, say Wheel of Time, and it'll become associated in my head with whatever music I'm listening to at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So 10 years ago, reading it for the very first time, for whatever reason, I just have linked in my head forever Wheel of Time and Foo Fighters. I don't know why.
Wow.
So.
Wow. That's interesting.
I can see that because you have a big association with music to stuff that happens, especially when you first start, you know, to listen to it. So, mm-hmm. You know, smells, cookings, and definitely the things you're reading. Do you think that if you went back and listened to something else, I'm asking a follow-up question, the mic's not anywhere near you, but do you think if you went back and listened to something else while you're reading that book, it would change your perception of the book?
I would probably change my association because rereading The Wheel of Time a second time, I don't associate it with Foo Fighters anymore, but sometimes I'll listen to some old Foo Fighters and occasionally think of, say, Eye of the World or something.
That stuff will pop up.
It kind of a lingering connection.
That's cool.
I've been watching a show on the Discovery Channel called The Colony. Has anyone seen it?
I've heard of it.
It's super. It's pretty cool. I think it's pretty cool. But it keeps making me think about Fallout 3. Because it's a post-apocalyptic world, and they're trying to, like, you know, build things together and make different contraptions to survive, and everyone has different skills, and it makes me think of the way you can, like, give yourself perks and build up your skills. And I'm like, man, if I was in a post-apocalyptic society, I have nothing to offer. I am not a breeder, maybe. I am, like, that's the best I can give. I'm not, like, I can do computers, but if there's no electricity, I don't think I could build a computer from scrap pieces. Like, you know, if they were all, thank you. I need a little more imagination, liquid imagination. But yeah, it is interesting how things get linked in your head like that, or they bring up such vivid scenes in your mind that they just kind of permanently stay in your foresight like that.
Definitely. I've had that thing that he mentioned about places, you know, when mm-hmm. I'm reading a book and I see a place, I'm like, oh, that looks like the scene in the book that I'm talking about. And then that place will always have that association for me.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Our next question, comment.
I just want to say I don't ever actually have this problem because if I see a book based on a video game, I go play the video game.
Hmm. That's based on the actual game, though. I think we're more talking about, like, different kinds of media that remind you of other media. So, like, Warcraft 3 would be the game, and the Forever War is the book, but they for some reason, it resonates in her mind as being a similar thing.
Right, and that's, you know, there are, you know, it's an interesting point, though, because Lord of the Rings is going to remind me of every Lord of the Rings game. You know, there's some books out there that already are so translated at this mm-hmm. point. But I wonder what Philip K. Dick, Man in the High Castle, would associate with what video game. I can't even think. Hmm.
Drugs.
What?
Drugs?
You would associate it with drugs.
Well, there is that. Or crazy.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Well, this is a little different, but sort of the same. I have a lot of disparate interest. I love technology. I love sci-fi. And sometimes I forget which of my friends likes what. So, for instance, I'll be talking to my friend, and I'll be reminded about something that was on Buzz Out Loud. And I'll start to go, and I'll be like, they don't know that, and I'll stop. And then I look sad, and the conversation ends.
Yeah. I just then I'll be when I was on Buzz Out Loud.
I'd be like, okay. And then I'll be talking to another friend, and it'll remind me of something that happened on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and I have to think, I'm like, do they like Buffy the Vampire Slayer? And I'm like, in that period of time, they're just staring at me, and I'm like, never mind.
Yeah, and then
I have to do that with everything, Stargate, everything. So I'm always having to filter, which friend am I talking to? Do they like this? I don't remember.
And if you guess wrong, then it's just, you know, you have to end up spending hours explaining.
Or I just get the blank stare.
Yeah.
I get a lot of blank stares.
I think we all know those blank stares very well.
Oh, believe me, I'm right there with you.
I actually told someone at work the other day, people don't understand me, don't worry about it. And they went on about their business.
Our next comment comes from Chris on the Ning group at swordandlaser.ning.com about District 9. How many people saw District 9? I don't think there's any spoilers in here for those you didn't. Chris says, okay, maybe I'm jaded, but I don't get it. District 9 was a complete letdown to me. I left the theater feeling like I'd seen that theme done a dozen times, usually more successfully. I don't want to drop any spoilers, so I won't go into detail, but for someone who is into sci-fi, District 9 presents well-trod themes in a typical, unimaginative manner. The CGI was pretty interesting, but that's about the only notable thing for me. I didn't dislike the movie, but geez, I've seen people raving about it like it's Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I'd rather watch a rerun of Enemy Mine.
Or Alien Nation. Really, he's seen a lot of apartheid alien movies. That's really fascinating to me. I didn't know there were a lot of those out there.
I get what he's saying about it's a theme that has been done, right? But I disagree that it has been done in this way. I think this is a totally new way of doing it.
I agree, personally. But I just thought it was such an interesting, quick-moving, fascinating experience. Like, I just felt totally drawn into it for the entire duration of the movie. Well, except for the part where I blacked out.
Oh, right. What happened there?
It's kind of a disgusting movie, yeah. Yeah, I don't do well with, like, horror or, like, scary themes very well. I'm just not good with it visually. And but I knew I really wanted to see this. I knew there were probably going to be some startling moments, so I prepared myself mentally. And then we got into the theater, and there were all these freaking horror trailers before the movie started. And I started getting more and more tense, you know, like kind of drawing within myself and being like, oh, this is not good. Is this going to be worse than I thought it was going to be? Is this going to be way scarier than I imagined? And don't worry, Brian, it wasn't like Jurassic Park. Okay, just making sure. And inside joke, sorry. And so once the movie got rolling, and I don't want to do any spoilers, but there's a certain fingernail scene.
All of a sudden,
my stomach started feeling really warm, and I was like, that's a weird feeling. And then all of a sudden, my hands and arms started tingling, and I'm like, that's not normal. And then my whole body broke out in a cold sweat, and I blacked out. And then I woke up like a second later, and I was like, I don't feel so good. And I was like, I didn't leave because the perspiration actually cooled me down quite a bit. And then I felt fine. I saw the rest of the movie and I was okay.
I've been telling Veronica she should use that as a rating system for movies.
Yeah.
One blackout.
I really want to put myself in that situation again. Thanks, Tom. But I felt really good because I was like brave enough to handle the movie. I felt like I had accomplished something. But I don't agree with this guy. I think he's crazy.
I don't think he's crazy. I think he's being a little more jaded than most, because you know, the idea of the alien being rejected, the idea of sort of apartheid. That sure, these themes are common, but I have never seen it done where aliens are the totally non-threatening, prejudiced against race in a movie form. I maybe it's been done before, but I haven't seen it.
Please correct us if you guys have any other examples to give about why you think it was, you know, trite or redone
And yeah, the plot jumps around a little bit, but overall, I thought it was pretty.
But that kind of worked with the way the story was being told, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it had that kind of cinema verite.
That could be one criticism too, though, is it starts off as a very documentary feel, and then it kind of slips into a regular storytelling feel later on.
Yeah.
Any other comments before we move along?
District 9 comments, anything?
We got one right here.
It actually goes back and forth between documentarian mm-hmm. and regular movie quite frequently, to the point to where it seemed effortless to me.
Yeah, like I didn't really notice it.
It switched gears quite a bit. But I think what the person's reacting to is it's a redemption story, and there are a million of redemption stories. And that's why it seems familiar.
The unlikely hero.
That's a good
scenario.
Way. Yeah, you're right. That's the way to put it. It's a redemption story, but it's a unique one. I don't, you know. I mean, you can say that all the tropes have been used. I mean, you can say that about any story that with this story at some boiled down level has been told before. Oh, I stole your comment. I'm sorry.
That was a good comment. Good thought.
Edit that out.
God, Tom.
I actually am not disagreeing with you guys because I love the movie, but I think probably maybe his reaction is to people's overly loving the movie. But for me as a sci-fi fan, it's the first sci-fi movie I've seen in a long time with that strong social commentary. Mm-hmm. And when I watch sci-fi and horror, I look for that. That means something, you know. Even back to like Dawn of the Dead and the whole consumerism, you know, thing that they were doing in that film. So I think it's typical, like with fandom, a lot of times where if everybody loves something too much, somebody's got to find a reason to hate it. And I'm a documentary filmmaker. Anytime I see that style of filmmaking, I get passionate about it too.
Yeah, so.
Absolutely. And I think Roger Chang and I, who do East Meets West together, have talked about this before. Where, you know, there's sci-fi is a great place to tell these sort of commentary on society things, you know, going all the way back into the 1800s and the time machine. And
well, yeah, plus you can be so abstract about it. You don't have to take a direct route into the message. You know, you can kind of make it interesting and different and draw people in to understand the message without hitting them over the head with it.
Like the people with the face divided into white on one side and black on the other in Star Trek.
Yeah.
That's silly. There's no difference between them. What is that a metaphor for? All right, we got another one over here.
I think just as a rubric for the film, I'm a college student, and my sociology teacher recommended the film and even said, watch it for extra credit. So that says volumes right there.
You get credit
Your
for watching District 9.
Professor is
yeah,
awesome.
I'm going to that college.
So I'll go out on a limb. I actually didn't like District 9.
Excellent.
So I may be the only one.
Security helped him make it out of the room safely. We don't want
him,
anyone
right?
to jump.
Just kidding.
So, I mean, it's about racism, and obviously it's about District 6, which was the district of Johannesburg that they did move a bunch of people out, mm-hmm. and exact same reasons they gave at the beginning of the movie. I thought it was a really shallow treatment of racism. Like, he says all these negative things, the same negative things they said about black Muslims in Johannesburg, but then he doesn't make any of them sentimental except this one guy, Christopher, who's the only alien who wears pants or a shirt. So I felt like he understood racism was bad, but he never actually painted the aliens sympathetically. So
okay. I don't know if I agree.
I think that bothered me.
I felt that the aliens were, well, I can see where you're coming from. I didn't feel that way, but I can definitely see how, you know, they were shown in a very negative light throughout a lot of the documentary footage, and I don't think it gave the viewer a chance to really connect with them as much as they could. But I think that you know, they did a really good job with the aliens in themselves, that even though they looked very alien and, you know, prawn-like, as they like to say, there was a lot of expression in their faces, and you could really kind of feel that humanness, I guess, inside of them, that kind of made you connect with them even though maybe they weren't acting in the best way all the time.
All right, we can take one more comment or question before we move along. I thought I saw like six hands. Oh, there's one over there.
Hi, Jack Jaffe. I'll see you in a panel a little bit. I got to go against what he said about the racism in District 9. It's always, in American films, it's always too easy. It's always love the other. It's always so obvious, the choices. Mm-hmm. And District 9 actually took a hard look the other way. And yes, they should have had more prawns that were a little bit more redemptive, but then again, I'd argue Christopher is the only one that they even explored, really, other than his kid. His kid was pretty nice.
His kid was pretty awesome, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think you can make a really good argument, as you have, if looking at it as a racism allegory, the issues with the story. But I guess I wasn't coming at it that direction. I was coming at it as an alien story, and as a sci-fi story, it's really unique. So I think that is a testament to the film, is that it has got that many different levels that you can criticize it with.
Yeah. All right, well, excellent. I think it's time now to bring on our guest author for the evening, Timothy Zahn.
Thanks for coming. Timothy Zahn won the Hugo Award in 1984 for his novella Cascade Point. He's probably best known for the popular Star Wars sequels known as the Thrawn Trilogy. They were authorized by Lucas, took place after the Return of the Jedi, if you have somehow escaped their notice. He has also written the Dragonback series and the Conqueror's Trilogy, which is about a war between humans and aliens. Welcome to Sword and Laser.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, you studied as a physicist, right?
Yes, I was in physics for undergrad and grad school. Started out writing as a hobby after seeing a very abysmal episode of The Invisible Man with David McCallum. Decided I could write a better story than that. I couldn't, but I discovered it was fun, so I kept going with that. So when my advisor died of a heart attack, I decided to take on writing full-time for a while and see if that would work, and so far it seems to be working okay.
Yes, it definitely seems to be.
It was in 79, by the way, so it's working so far.
Now, you have an interesting way of creating a plot and building a story. Can you tell us a little bit about how that works and how you pick the central events that you build around?
Well, my typical technique is to... My stories tend to be plot-driven, or at least start out as plot. So I will work out a plot. This is the basics, the situation, this is the problem they're going to run into, this is some of the contortions they're going to go through trying to solve the problem, this is how the actual problem will be solved. Along the way, the characters start out as cardboard cutouts. So, okay, I need a villain here, let's call him Grand Admiral Thrawn. We'll need someone to be kind of a foil for Luke, we'll call her Mara Jade. And as I develop the storyline, as I develop the plot and the details, the characters flesh out as well. So instead of a cardboard cutout, now this person's got these characteristics, this kind of personality, will have this kind of interaction with the other characters. So by the time I finish my outline, I basically know most everything about where I'm going to go in the story.
I hear a lot of authors say, and I've actually experienced this a little bit in the little writing that I've done, where characters start to do things on their own when you start writing them. Have you experienced that?
My characters are generally better behaved than that. They generally do what I tell them to. I've had a character take over about a page, and they suddenly realize, no, I can't go this direction because the rest of the storyline requires it to go this direction, so I back up and do that. What I have had is characters who I thought would be minor becoming more major, getting into a better, bigger role, not exactly taking over, but suddenly there's more for them to do.
Characters with good agents.
Yeah, characters with good agents, yes. That must be it.
So when writing the Star Wars books, how much guidance and input do you get from the Lucas Empire?
The Lucas Empire, I like that.
Or Alliance.
You know, whatever.
Republic.
Whatever.
I'm comfortable with both groups. The first book, the Thrawn Trilogy, Heir to the Empire, I was given two guidelines. I was to start 3 to 5 years after Jedi, and I could use anybody who had not been killed in the movies.
Ah, you couldn't bring them back.
Right.
Okay.
But if they killed in novelization, apparently was okay, because that wasn't officially what Lucas had done. Mm-hmm. So that was all I was given. Now, once I submitted an outline and then the final manuscript, there were things they would... They tell me, though, you can't do this. But I was given a wide open field, and that's still somewhat the case. I've got one more Star Wars book contracted for. It'll be my 9th. You still submit an outline, and they tell you whether or not all the details work, this will not work, whatever. It's sort of like running into the boundaries of your basketball court or whatever. Mm-hmm. You're suddenly outside of what they will permit. But I've only had a couple of times where they've even said, we'd like you to put this character in the book because we're trying to coordinate several appearances of the character in games and comics and such.
Can you say what character that was? Or?
It was one of the characters in Survivor's Quest. And I forget who he was. He was Well, I mean, it was fine. I don't think they ever actually did anything with the character, but this was the grand scheme at the time. They said, we'd like you to put this kind of character in. I thought, okay, I can fit him into the story here. And a younger version of him was instrumental in Outbound Flight, which is kind of connected to Survivor's Quest thematically. And it's a prequel. It's a duology with a 50-year gap in the middle, basically. But most of the time, they've never told me I need to do a particular plot point or anything of that sort. So it's been really enjoyable working with Lucasfilm. Otherwise, it wouldn't keep coming back.
So there was recently a major Star Wars game release, Force Unleashed. Do you have any plans to tie any of those characters into the storyline, or is that too disparate?
I avoid video games like the plague because I will never get any work done. yes, somebody else who's been there. Yeah, there's a limited amount of stuff you can tie in. One of the advantages of my next book is it fits in between A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back, mm-hmm. where there isn't an awful lot. There are a couple of books. There's a whole stack of Marvel comics, but the area hasn't been dug up so much as post-Jedi or some of the other eras. So basically, I've got the movie characters, whatever I want to throw in. I can ignore a lot of the other stuff that's coming out elsewhere. And frankly, I can't keep up with it all anyway.
There's a lot of it.
Yeah.
Now, yeah, I know you're not beholden to things like the Marvel Comics series necessarily, it sounds like. But do you ever consciously say, you know what, I do want to make an allusion to that or pull that in somehow?
I did not read a lot of the Marvel Comics. I read some of them. I have pulled in various things. One of the things I did was in, let's see, Spectre of the Past, I talked about the Starspeeder 3000. Anybody know where that's from? Star Tours, the Disney ride, the Starspeeder 3000. And I put in a couple of, I think I've had a reference to Star Tours in that same book. Only later did I find out that Disney doesn't have a sense of humor necessarily, but apparently nobody noticed. Except the people who worked at Star Tours, because I heard from one person he had copied the section where it's referenced and put it up in their ready room for all the employees to see. So, we're canon, sort of.
Ish.
It's canon-ish, yeah. And I was able to put the 501st into a novel for the first time, too.
Oh, fantastic.
But, of course, one of the things about this business is no matter what you do, somebody can always trump you, Rose Bowl Parade. He brings them all in from all the world.
Right,
now they're really official.
501st Stormtrooper Brigade, if anyone listening doesn't know. Now, you briefly mentioned the old gang is coming back in a new series. That's going to be released sometime 2011?
Yeah, it's a standalone book at the moment. It's not a series.
Okay.
At the moment, we're doing books kind of one at a time is how I'm being contracted. It'll be shortly after Allegiance, for those who are following a Star Wars book. So it's between A New Hope, Empire Strikes Back. And we'll have the traditional, the classic Star Wars gang, plus some characters I invented. And, you know, the typical rollicking good fun that Star Wars is known for.
All right, we have a question from our forums at swordandlaser.ning.com. Sean writes, what would the galaxy be like if Grand Admiral Thrawn had won? Would it be better or worse than how it's turned out under the New Republic?
Well, my considered opinion is that we would have stomped the Yuuzhan Vong a lot faster. I think part of his reasoning for wanting to get the Empire back was to have the order, stability, unity that an empire gives that, frankly, the New Republic does not necessarily have. Mm-hmm. Certainly the Old Republic didn't. And to have all of the forces available to hit at the Vong and take them out much faster. But then it would have been fewer books for the New Jedi Order. So, you know, these things have ups and downs.
And the bad guys win and all that.
That's from your point of view, of course.
Right. I'm bringing my own politics into it. Yep. You're right. Is it something that you can do, though? I mean, have the Empire win something? Is that something that would be okay?
I think not only would I hit the edge of the basketball court at that point, I would hit into a wall. Now, I had to not argue, but I had to be firm in the Hand of Thrawn duology, Spectre of the Past, Vision of the Future, when I wanted to end the war against the Empire. It was 10 years after the Thrawn trilogy, chronologically. And I said, if I'm going to do these two books, I want to end that war. I want to have a peace treaty done. We've done all that we can do, really, with the Empire as an enemy. Let's now have them as, if not an ally, at least not someone who's taking pot shots at us. So Lucasfilm, one of the good things about Lucasfilm, or at least the people I've worked with there, is that they are open to having their minds changed. They will tell me, you can't do this. And I will say, I would like to do this because I have this thing that'll come out of that, this thing, it'll tie into that, it'll be a much more powerful sort of thing. And more often than not, I can persuade them to let me do it once I give them a good logical reason. They will not back themselves into corners where they really can't get out. And that's very nice because, you know, they've got the veto power and they should, it's their property. On the other hand, I've got some ideas that I think work well with Star Wars, and the win-win situation is always the best thing to come out with.
Another question from Skip on the Ning Forum. He says, I'd like to know what Timothy is reading and what he's read this year. I know I bought the first Dresden Files book on Michael Stackpole's recommendation after he read The Galley.
Sadly, I find it almost impossible to read fiction these days because I can't read for enjoyment. I read, it's like research. I find myself analyzing the story, analyzing the characters, analyzing the dialogue. It's just not fun anymore. So most of what I read these days is nonfiction. I've done a lot, read a lot of World War II stuff. Incidentally, we're talking about the music and game and connection. I've probably got the most out of the way one anybody. This came out of high school. I still associate Mendelssohn's Hebrides Overture, for those who are familiar with that, with the rise and fall of the Third Reich. Because I was playing it while I was reading the book.
Uh-huh.
Go figure. I still have that connection. So mostly I've got World War II, some underseas salvage operations. I read a book, what was it, 1604 or something, The Great Chinese Expedition Around the World that discovered the New World a century before Columbus. Fascinating stuff. And I'm reading one right now that is speculating that the American Indian, or whatever they're called these days, Native Americans, cultures and societies were far more advanced than anybody now realizes before the Europeans came. And they're just now trying to figure out what were the actual numbers. How did all this get wiped out? Mm-hmm. So a lot of historical stuff and just general. I read a couple of books on the John Adams to John Quincy Adams, which is fascinating because whenever you have a history book, every author's got their own point of view. And some will say, this was a great, you know, a good presidential combination. The others say these were terrible. So it's funny to kind of read history through the filter of somebody's research.
Do you pull things from those books into the things you're writing as parallels? Or is this just, you know, it's relaxation for you because it's not fiction and you won't have to analyze it?
It's a little both. It's relaxation, but also it'll spark ideas and thoughts. I've got something I actually caught from my History Channel thing on the Revolutionary War that I think I'm going to incorporate into the next Star Wars book. Anything an author reads goes into this grab bag in the back of their brain, and it gets combined with other things, you know, convoluted, turned upside down, inside out, you know, painted purple, and eventually will come out as something entirely different. All the history, all of the other stuff will eventually come out somehow.
It's just part of the blender up there.
Yeah,
yeah, definitely. All right. Well, if we have any questions on the floor for Timothy Zahn, you're welcome to just raise your hand, and John will bring the
run
mic
that
over
mic
to
guy
you.
Run him ragged tonight.
My question for Timothy is if you can tell us a little bit about working in that collective environment of different authors working in the same universe. Do you communicate with each other? And feel free to not be specific, but has anyone ever written one of your characters in a way that just made you say, oh, they wouldn't do that?
Yes. Moving along. In the early days of Star Wars, you have to understand that in 91, when Heir to the Empire came out, nobody knew whether anybody cared about Star Wars. I know this is hard to believe now, but nobody knew whether anybody would buy a Star Wars book of any sort. The last movie had been in 83, so it was kind of a gamble on Bantam's part. And so Lucasfilm was caught completely by surprise, which meant they didn't have a whole lot of a workable Bible worked out. The only people working at that point were West End Games doing the role-playing game, and Dark Horse Comics had started a new series as well, plus the old Marvel and some of the old novels as well. So for the years, there was kind of a scramble to get things organized, and it was pretty chaotic. Some of the writers knew each other and so would communicate back and forth. I did a lot with Mike Stackpole, and I did a lot of cross-pollinization between our books and a lot of linkages back and forth. And then Mike and Aaron did when they were both doing X-Wing books. But it was still kind of hit or miss. The editors hoped Lucasfilm and the authors knew what was going on. The authors hoped Lucasfilm and the editors knew what was going on, etc. In the past few years, Lucasfilm made a concerted effort to actually get everything down on paper or in electrons. And we now have this thing called the Holocron, which is a CD-ROM that lists everything, that and it's updated periodically.
Who wants that CD-ROM?
Yes. So, for example, I don't have my new one yet. It's not. It wouldn't be here anyway, so don't bother breaking into my room. For example, you can go to the you can type in Grand Admiral Thrawn, and it will give you a listing of everything that has been written or in the games or in the comic books or anything on Grand Admiral Thrawn. And the really fun part about the whole thing is every entry has this little box, little square up near the top. It says, if checked, click here for continuity problems. And the continuity problems are everything from this name is spelled three different ways in different sources, all the way up to this character appears to be in two places at once, deal with it.
Yeah.
Because it's simply...
Clones.
It was, yeah, that's it.
Parallel universe.
My take on it is this is a real history, and historians occasionally or often screw up.
Yeah.
So we can explain a lot away that way. But yeah, I'm expecting my new Holocron before I get started on the new book in a few weeks.
I'm sort of shocked that they were that unsteady about whether those books would do well, because I remember when I heard the announcement that you were writing them and that they were coming out, I was like, what took them so long? You know, I've been dying for this sort of material.
Well, Bantam sent out their sales force with instructions to try to get enough pre-orders to print 100,000 copies. The first printing was actually 80,000. I can see the bookstores saying, Star Wars, that's old. Star Trek's what's big. I'll take a box. That first printing sold out in, I think, 2 weeks. And my editor called me, said they were going back for 70, I think, didn't they? No, 60,000. 60,000 additional copies. She called the next day and said, no, we're going to do two printings of 30,000 each because we can get them out faster if we do it that way. Heir to the Empire was actually in hardcover for a couple of years, still being printed in hardcover, I think 2 years or so after the paperback came out. More than 2 years. My wife is the memory in our family and these things.
You're the Holocron in the...
Yes. But my agent pointed out to me, this is, I think he used a bad word, never happens. So, I mean, again, it's hard to envision now, but nobody knew, because there was nothing for the fan base to grab onto. It was all, people sometimes say, well, you restarted Star Wars. No, I got to stick a fork in the pie crust and show how much steam there still was underneath.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there was definitely a lot of steam.
Lots.
Other questions?
One of my favorite characters is Mara Jade, mm-hmm. and I was wondering if there was anything in particular that inspired you in her creation, and also if you had any type of input or control over where her character went after you left her.
Everything we do for Star Wars is owned by Lucasfilm. We have no control, no anything. All of the authors, that's the deal you make when you do a Star Wars or a Trek or a Buffy book. It's owned by the media people, as it should be. So once Mara Jade is out of my hands, other authors are perfectly at liberty to do anything else they want with her or any of my other characters. A friend of mine once coined the term out of character experience when a character just doesn't seem right because somebody else is messing with them. And this is one reason I never did any other author's characters in my books except Mike Stackpole's, and only because I would vet things past him to make sure I was getting Corin Horn or Booster Tarek correct. What inspired Mara Jade? Just she started that cardboard cutout, somebody to kind of link the opening of Return of the Jedi with the war against the Empire, an agent of the Emperor here to kill Luke. And she sort of fleshed out into the kind of character. I think what her appeal is, women would like to be her, and men would like to have her at their side in trouble. I'd like to have her at my side in trouble. Go in and talk to the bank about a loan. Mara, come here.
I recently read one of your books, Manta's Gift, mm-hmm. Which took a new idea, and the aliens in that book were foreign in a way that we've never seen before. And readers evolve, and you know, aliens as humanoids become harder and harder to believe. And I'm just curious, what is your take on having to keep up with I guess, the evolution of the reader, and having to make new ideas?
I try to stay at least a little bit ahead of the reader as far as being able to entertain and surprise and not get into the, oh, that's just same old type of thing. I mean, we ran into that with the discussion about the District 9.
Yeah.
My mother-in-law was visiting for 10 weeks. She's 92. We got out to see one movie this summer, so.
And if you only see one movie this summer, what was it?
We saw Harry Potter. But we couldn't leave her alone very much. So anyway, we're way behind on our movie viewing. I don't know what the audience is wanting necessarily. I know what I want to write, and I know what kind of characters, interactions, situations I want to do. And I can just hope that I will hit that chord with the readers to make them want to keep reading it. If they don't, I'm going to have to find honest work somewhere.
All right, we got one more question back there in the back. So just far enough to make John have to walk as far as he can, and everybody stare at. Okay, there we go.
Just out of curiosity, BioWare coming out with The Old Republic and being the masters of storytelling they are in their medium, have they approached you to develop any kind of literature to tie into that realm at all?
I have not been communicated with by any of the game companies. In fact, typically I find out about one of my characters in a Star Wars game when someone says, hey, Grand Admiral Thrawn's in the new Star Wars game. So, I mean, not only do they own it, they have no, there's no obligation for anybody to talk to me about it. I'd love to be involved, especially since our son just graduated with a degree in digital entertainment and game design. I'd love to get involved in the company
time.
And get him a job. But so far, I've not been able to make any traction of that. I got into comic books a little with Dark Horse, and I did one three-part Marvel comic, and I've kind of tried off and on to get back into the comic business, and I can't get into that either. So I have this talent for kind of hitting the downward slope of a lot of things.
It must be really, really different when you're writing your own work that's entirely yours and how you handle those characters versus handling these characters that are, in some cases, iconic, like Luke and Leia. In some cases, characters that you're inventing, but you know they're not yours. They're going to be handed over to this franchise. Is there anything conscious that you do that you're saying, yeah, I'm going to handle this differently?
If my name's on the book, I'm going to do the best job I possibly can. It would be nice to have Mara Jade as my own character to do with outside of Star Wars books. She's not, but I can play, you know, play with her and Thrawn and Luke and Leia and everybody else in the Star Wars book. So, you know, it's you got to leave your toys at the other kid's house. But you can go there to play with them anytime they'll let you.
That's a very good way of putting it.
So we have time for maybe another question.
One more.
Maybe one or two.
So I loved Conqueror's Trilogy.
Thank you.
I think it's the first time I've ever seen a book where the first book is about how the evil aliens ambush the innocent humans, and the second book is about how the evil humans ambush the innocent aliens. What inspired you to write that sort of mistaken war?
I'm known for in some circles as a military science fiction writer because of the black collars, the Cobras, new Cobra series coming out, by the way. Starting December, and things like the Conquerors. It just seemed, I like the idea of not the gory part of war, but of the conflict and the resolution. and having, with Conquerors particularly, it was, we're on the way to a major blowout war. Can the human family, the Kavanaughs, and the Zsirsch family, Thurgalag and his family, can we figure out what's going on and get it stopped before there is no stopping it? And yeah, that was a unique for me approach, where the first book, by the end of the first book, you want the humans to beat these evil Zsirsch. By the end of the second book, once you've seen the Zsirsch point of view, you don't want them to lose either. And then we've got the third book to resolve it. Actually, if you read the dedication of that one, our son came up with the idea of part of that third book being coming from the point of view of one of the human weapons. So it's a computer that is part of one of the points of view. And he never lets me forget that and wants a royalty every time I get paid for it.
Awesome. All right, well, thank you so much, Timothy.
Yeah,
we really
thank
appreciate
you
coming
for
out
taking
here
the time to talk to us.
So we have a little treat today. We actually have the debut of the Sword and Laser t-shirts in-house. And we're going to give them to you. And we have a limited number. We have 144. They were designed by our dear friend Catherine, who's in the back today, and then lugged around also by Kim. And we would just want to thank Catherine for working so hard on the t-shirts and getting them printed. And we're really super excited about them. We will eventually have them and more products on the Sword and Laser store in time. But this is what we have for now. We wanted you guys to see them first and get your hands on them. And we also, yeah, go ahead, talk about the next thing.
Oh, yeah, I have a thing that's not on there. Want to thank all the folks at Dragon Con for the hard work in putting things together. Yes. Give them a round of applause. Derek and Swoopy and John
Derek,
today.
Yeah.
Everybody's been fantastic. It was really fun putting this together with them, and it's really fun been talking to you guys today. Next episode of Sword and Laser will be the Forever War recap. So if you still haven't had a chance to read it, it only takes an hour.
It's amazing.
Veronica.
It is a quick read, though, so you will have time to get it in before the recap.
That's right.
And we'll also kick off our next book after the Forever War in our next episode.
Yes, and since we just did a laser, it's time for a sword. And that sword is going to be Mists of Avalon by Marion Zimmer Bradley. So if you're excited about reading that, you can pick it up on our Amazon site or, your local bookstore.
Swordandlaser.com. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you so much.